Good evening and welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. We are coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm Douglas Mpuga. This evening, we'll talk about the concept of political leadership as a family business in Africa. And with us tonight is my colleague, Vincent Macquarie, Managing Editor, English to Africa TV. Vincent, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Very much welcome. And joining us from Durban, South Africa, is the regular panelist Suleiman Mugula. He's an independent panelist. Suleiman, welcome back to the show once again.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Very much welcome. As I said, tonight we're looking at the concept of political leadership as a business in Africa. So, first of all, let me begin with Vincent here. We've seen this happen across the continent, right from Mubarak had groomed his sons. Gaddafi had done the same. Mugabe tried to have the rumor that his wife, Grace, would have become president if things had worked differently. Kabila's son ruled for many years. Nasimbe Yedema did the same. Museven has his son as a general. So how do you, what's your comment about this trend?
Yes. You know, the trend that we've witnessed over the years across the continent, and as you've rightly pointed out, the countries, whether you're talking about Libya with Gaddafi, Mubarak in Egypt, or you go all the way down through the East African region, Museveni, you go to down to Zimbabwe, there's one common thread in all those, in that these are those regimes where presidents or leaders of those countries stay in power for so long. In all those cases, people have been in power for decades. And what that tells you is that over time, those people tend to have the mindset that the country belongs to them. It's a personal thing. It's a family enterprise. And that's why they always tout themselves as the only leader who can lead their country, the only person out of the millions of citizens who can lead their country. Now, the only other best person after the after himself is usually his son, or in a few cases, his wife. And what that tells you is that he, as I've said it before, they stay in power for too long. They end up having this disdain for the rest of the citizens and start believing that everybody else is incapable of running the country. But not only because they don't have the capacity to do that, because over the time of staying in power, because of the corruptive nature of power, and the disdain they have for the people, they start seeing the country as a personal family enterprise, and that's why you can see how they run the day-to-day affairs of the country is according to their personal desires. The interest of the nation really is never a priority. You can look at any of those countries. The president, his family are doing so well almost always. They're wealthy. They personalize the wealth of the nation, whether it is the resources like in the Equatorial Guinea. The wealth becomes, the oil wealth of the country becomes a personal property, and they live lavishly. They have homes abroad. They have everything. But you look at all those countries, they generally are doing badly, of course, with exception like Libya was doing well. Egypt definitely, you know, is a stronger economy compared to some of those other countries. But generally, in most of those cases, the countries are doing so badly, but the leaders are doing so well, and it's usually just concentrated around the president, his family, and perhaps a few friends. So the small, you know, in conclusion, I just want to say what binds all those is that staying too long in power leads to people believing that the country and the leadership of that country is a family enterprise.
Suleiman, Vincent seems to suggest that maybe the longevity of the leaders in power contributes to this sort of father-to-son transition. What say you?
The most worrying aspect about it, I agree with Vincent, is that number one, they are increasing in number. When you look at the continent, the number of dictators who have decided to personalize their countries is becoming more and more. It is becoming a norm now on the continent. It's very difficult now when you look at the numbers to even decide whether Africa is going forward or is going backward, as if it is now regressing now. What is also worrying, secondly, is that they have become more and more shameless. While the other countries and the international community is emphasizing democracy, they have actually vulgarized democracy. They have stayed long, but they have decided to become elected monarchs. They have subverted the constitution. They have changed the constitution. They are being elected. They manipulated the election. They have manipulated the term limits. So, in other words, they have become owners of this country, the way Vincent has said. The last worrying part of it, in addition to what Vincent has said, is that they are internationally supported. They are well armed by the international community. They are well financed by the international community. They are morally supported by the international community. If we start with the latest one, the one in Chad, sincerely speaking, after the death of Idriss Deby, the people in Chad rejected the new leadership of his son. They went on the street. But as they were demonstrating, it was France, the president of France, who was the first to come and give them the tacit support, which enabled them to gain that confidence to be able to start firing at people and killing people. Later on, other international countries will start supporting them, and then the son will take root, and then he will join the other sons who have inherited the thrones from their fathers. So I think, as Vincent has said, the longevity has contributed very much to these people becoming immune to criticism, becoming more and more shameless, becoming more and more callous, becoming more and more unbothered about what is happening in their particular countries.
I see. Vincent, maybe we should make it clear to our listeners that the idea of political dynasties exists elsewhere. Even here in America, from Quincy Adams' time to his son, George Bush Senior to his son, but there's a difference on the African continent.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, political dynasties are not unique to the African continent, but they're unique to the African continent is in a certain aspect. If you just take the example of the United States, the sons or family members of a person who's been president somewhere along the way may be groomed or aspire to become president, and because of the prominent positions they hold along the way, they get the advantage, of course. But then, in the United States, these are all subjected to the normal democratic process. They may have the advantage of being associated with the president. They may have the advantage of being associated with the ruling party. But they have to go through the same process as everybody else, campaign, yes. Go through a nomination process, be subjected to serious debates and vetting within the party. Remember that to get into the nomination, you have to go around the country to campaign. So in other words, even if you're the son of the president, as it was with George W. Bush, coming after his father, George H.W. Bush, he had to go to the country and had to prove to the people that he could become a good president. But remember, even George W. Bush had been a governor locally, had already actually been a leader at the local level. Even the other son of George Bush, Jeb Bush, had been governor in Miami, in Florida, while the brother was governor in Texas. So the point is, they still have to prove themselves. Hillary Clinton, who nearly became president of this country, as having been a first lady, she had to go through the process and try to sell herself to the country. It wasn't just enough that she, I mean, the president, whoever is the president of the United States, is not going to just install the person or put the person in on the throne, but he may support the person, he may support the wife or the son, but they have to go through the rigors of campaigning and selling their agenda and their platform. And remember, they get opposition from within their own party, and sometimes, you know, they manage to get through as to be nominees, or sometimes they don't. So, but on the continent, what are we witnessing is that the son of the president is just a president in waiting. It's not going to be put through parliament or any, even if it's put through a parliament, it is an endorsement. It's just a rubber stamping. We saw what happened in Chad just the other day. How do you explain that in the midst of all that, whatever you could call chaos, the son of the president, a very young fellow, naturally becomes the acting president or the leader of the council, the military council, and yet, you know, the country has technically has a democratic system. So, yes, in short, these are different in that sense, in that the dynasties in Africa are not based on a democratic succession, but actually they are literally business affair, and where the president has the absolute power and determines who becomes the next president, which in this case becomes their own son.
I see. So, Suleiman, go ahead.
And Douglas, compared to the international community elsewhere, in Africa, most of these leaders did not get into power through democratic means. In 1967, Nyasimbe in Togo took over power through a military coup. Then he led the country for 38 years, up to 2005. In 2005, his son took over. He completed 15 years last year, and now he has changed the constitution again after completing the 10 years. He changed the manipulated the constitution. Now, for Nyasimbe now, the young one, is going on so to make it 40 years. That is unfair. That is scandalous. It is not justifiable at all. So are the same. Look at Uganda, where the son is in waiting. The man has been in power over 30 years. Now, if the son is takeover is about 47 years, he's going to go another 20 years up to the age of his father. They have personalized this country unjustifiably, and it cannot be allowed. That is why the young people now are deciding to go on the streets and refuse this succession and these dynasties in Africa.
I see. I guess what you're saying, both of you, is that the difference is that in Africa, it's succession by birth, whereas elsewhere, it's succession by competition. You compete fairly among other people, and if you win, you can succeed your father if you want.
Yes. You know, you can compare it to a business. A country, basically, is supposed to be a shareholding company. I mean, it's a place where all citizens are supposed to be equal shareholders of the country's interest and of the country today and the future of it. So when it comes to selecting the next chairman of the board or the next CEO, all the citizens are supposed to participate in determining who becomes the next CEO. Now, in the context of Africa, it behaves like a solely family-owned business, where the father is the CEO, and when he goes, of course, naturally, because it's a personal business, one of the family members has to be installed as the next CEO or chairman. So you see that there's a big difference there. It's how you view the country. If this country is not your personal property, you cannot just install your son or wife to the seat. You have to allow the citizens, who are the real shareholders, the real owners of the country, to determine. Leadership, ideally, is a privilege and an honor by the citizens. You are not necessarily the best person to run the country, but the people bestow upon you and give you the benefit of doubt that you will give them direction. You will represent their interests. When you are a dictator, your mindset is different. You see yourself as a person who is doing people the favor of ruling over them. You see yourself as the person having the absolute wisdom, and everybody else is stupid, and you're there to, as a savior. I overheard one time an East African president, saying that he will be there for so long because the people want him to be there for as long as, you know, he can still walk. Now, as far as he's concerned, he's the smartest person in the country, and he has come to convince himself that the people think he's the only person who should continue being the president. The problem is, he knows very well that if anything happens, he has already positioned his son to become the next president. So, I mean, it's a totally warped kind of logic among those who stay on in power for too long in the continent of Africa.
Well, for those just joining us, you are listening to Reporters Roundtable. We are coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. Tonight, we are discussing the concept of political leadership as a family business in Africa. Our panelists are my colleague Vincent Macquarie, managing editor TV English to Africa, and Suleiman Mgula, an independent political analyst, and I'm your host Douglas Impuga here in Washington. Suleiman did mention briefly the relationship, the correlation between people who go to power by force tending more to want their family to be involved in the leadership of the country. Because even in Africa, as you know, there are leaders, sons of former presidents who have come to power through the normal way. Take, for instance, Uhuru Kenyatta in Kenya. He didn't ride on, his father didn't put him there to be the heir to the presidency, but he competed and came to power. But most of these others took power by force of arms and therefore wanted to maintain it in the family. Suleiman, maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit more.
Yes, they took power by force of arms. Not in addition to that, they took power without any agenda. They are fortune hunters. You take over the country when you don't have a program. Normal leadership demands that one has to have a manifesto. One has to have a program which has planned for the country. And that means you should have a collective, you should have inclusive, you should have the people of your country or the political party sits down, looks at what the country needs, and then they draw out the program. These people have got no program at all. If you look at these countries, I mean, in Chad, almost 50% of over 50% of the people are working in poverty. In Togo, over 50% of the population is working in poverty. Gabon, I mean, what are they doing apart from being fortune hunters working for themselves? In addition to that, if we have to understand the devastation which they have caused to these particular countries, look at the opposite. Look at the countries where we have had rotation of leaders, Senegal, even Kenya. There is some progress going on. There is the shift in policies. Look at Malawi. After Mutharika has gone, now Chawela is having a different direction altogether. The changes in the countries where there is change, there is always change. There is always hope for the people. There is always hope for better. But here the son does the exact thing, which the exact policies which the father has been carrying on. So the countries go poorer and poorer, the population loses hope, and then that is where you get the restrictions which we have on the continent, which means at the moment, the continent will not settle down until we have got a break in these dictatorial leaders who have decided to make dynasties in their particular countries.
Vincent, I think it's only possible to groom your son or wife to be next president only if you're a dictator. Otherwise, in a democracy, it's not easy.
Well, it's really no not easy to do that in a democracy. And in fact, we can make reference to Kenya, which Mhula just mentioned. Even when you look back at the not so long ago president, Daniel Arap Moi, who stayed in power for quite some time, 24 years,
yes.
One of the things that was strong was grew strong were the democratic institutions, and the systems became so powerful that he got to a point where he literally had to leave power, and the constitution had to be changed to allow multipartism and competitive politics. One of the things Moi never came closer to doing is to groom his own child into becoming the next president. In fact, none of his children became even member of parliament or any significant senior member of a government. They were mostly involved in private business, and of course they had the advantage of having their father as the president for so long. So the democratic institutions that had grown by that time, the pressure that was being faced, could not even allow any attempt. And why am I saying that? So in a country where there is some level of democracy, leaders are accountable to the people, leaders are accountable to the institutions. In a dictatorship, a president is accountable to nobody but himself. And that is why he can bring his own son and position him in whichever way. If you look at, for example, Chad, what we witnessed the other day wasn't just about an isolated case of the son who was in the military becoming the head of the military council, but all his family members already control the key sectors of the economy. One of his sons literally controls all the elements of import and export, the ports and all that. And I think the wife controlled some other big, influential kind of a sector of the economy. So these are situations where these presidents are at a point where they're not accountable to anybody. In fact, the parliament is accountable to them. The judiciary is accountable to that individual. The electoral system, even when they have this sham elections, the electoral commission is accountable to them. So they can do whatever they want. But in a true democracy, or where there is some democracy, an example has been given. Kenya is one example. You cannot do that because these institutions have become strong enough to hold that individual at bay, and the presidency, the president cannot afford to overstep certain lines, and so that makes the difference.
I see. So, in short, Suleiman, these leaders, it appears, would prefer a monarchy because that seems to be the setup of a monarch.
No, they are elected monarchs, but what is disappointing to the people of Africa is that the people themselves have rejected them. All over the continent, people are demonstrating, young people are demonstrating, but these people are callous. They come out and shoot them and kill them and imprison them and torture them. But what is most disappointing is that the international community somehow has given them moral support to continue. When they go for loans, they continue to give them loans. When they go for arms, they continue to give them arms. They continue to give them tear gas. They don't even worry. They continue to give them all the weaponry they need to suppress their people. And when they suppress them, they are not bothered. They just keep quiet, and the game continues. So that is the dilemma which the African continent is facing. I wish, or every African wishes, that the international community could at least put a stop so that there is a change. Otherwise, it doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help the continent, and neither in the long run will it help the international community themselves, because at the end of the day, Africa is going to become a burden to them.
I see. Vincent, the national...
chime in a little bit. It's okay?
Okay, go ahead.
You see, I think the continent of Africa, especially the citizens, have to realize that the international community is interested in its own interests. So whether you're talking about China or you're talking about the European countries or even the U.S., it's more about the interests of their countries and certain global interests that may be very strategic for these powers. An example, Chad. What have we seen there? And Mohula alluded to that. France is very involved in all those issues relating to how the country is run. And Idriss Deby was said to be a darling of the Western nations because he was fighting the Al-Qaeda-associated militants from the north of his country. Now, what did that mean to the West? It didn't really matter how he was running his own country. It didn't matter that he had been in power for 30 years. It didn't matter that he was oppressing people, he was suppressing the opposition. What counted is that he's helping to fight terrorism. To them, terrorism is a global threat. It is important to contain it right there so that nobody comes out of there to attack someone in the Western countries. They gave him the money. They gave him the weapon. They gave him all the resources he needed. It didn't matter how he was running his country. And this is what we've seen, whether you go back to the days of Mobutu Sese Seko, whether you go back to Egypt and Mubarak, it has always been how does that particular president serve the interest of the Western nations in terms of their strategic interests, whether it could be economic or security interests, whether you're in Djibouti and you've been in power for what, how many decades now, 40? They don't care. I mean, 30 years, I think, even in Djibouti. It's not a question of how good or bad a president you are to your people, but what interests can you serve the West? So all this talks about promoting human rights and other things, they're secondary. They're really secondary. It's about the interests of the countries in the West or even in the East, whether economic or security.
Yeah, it appears that's how it is. And what you hear most from these other countries is that they prefer stability, so long as the leader, they know. As the saying goes, the devil you know maybe is better than the one you don't know. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. This topic, maybe we shall revisit it as we see more of these father-to-son transitions continue to happen on the continent. And that wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. Thanks to my colleague, Vincent Makori, Managing Editor, TV, English to Africa, and Suleiman Mugula, an independent political analyst based in Durban, South Africa. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank
you.
You're very much welcome. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. A reminder that you can hear our roundtable on the internet. You can access it by going to the Voice of America main website and click on programs and scroll down to Reporters Roundtable. Once again, thanks very much for tuning in. And until next week, I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, wishing you all the best.
Hello, I am Shaka Fali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, after 29 years on air, Shaka Fali is retiring. Join him on his last show where he talks about his life and career and passes on the baton to Heidi Adams, the host who will lead the new Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Coming up, a conversation with Anurima Bhargava, chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Bhargava will explain why Sudan has made progress and why Nigeria has been officially designated as a country of particular concern and much more. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them
and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices.